Welcome to another edition of Sitting Around Talking Movies, the Talking Pictures podcast. I'm Neil Rosen, joined by Bill Brigoli.
I'm here.
And Bill McCuddy.
I was just walking by and it seemed like there was a podcast happening.
And Mike Sargent, who's joining us remotely. Hi, Mike.
The plans you refer to will soon be back in our plans.
Right, so the audio's bad enough and now you're making Darth Vader noises so nobody could understand you. So that's really good. Okay.
Oh, when can they?
All right. Well, we're talking about a lot of stuff today. We're going to talk about 12 Strong, the new movie with Chris Hemsworth. We're going to talk to Chris Hemsworth. We've got some little bit of an interview that Bill Brigoli did with him. We're going to talk about this great documentary that is on Hulu called Becoming Bond, which is about the life story of George Lazenby, the guy who took over for Sean Connery for one movie.
Trivia answer now on who played James Bond once.
Right, and we'll talk about the new David Letterman show called My Next Guest Needs No Introduction. Crashing, the Judd Apatow show, is back for a second season. Bill McCuddy and I saw that. We'll talk about that. On DVD is Last Flag Flying. We're going to talk about that. And I also saw the movie that won not only the Golden Globe, but the Critics' Choice Awards, called In the Fade. And then we're going to also talk about Me Too a little bit with a couple of stars that got into trouble, and we're going to see if their careers, so we're going to debate whether their careers are over, including
Woody Allen, this many years later. This blows my mind. We'll get to it later, I know.
We'll get to it later.
Wow, that's like crazy.
I know. Let's start out with actually the theatrical release of the week, which is 12 Strong, and Bill Brigoli saw it. Why don't you tell us about this movie, Bill? They're riding horses in Afghanistan or something like that? What's going on there?
That's right, and it takes place right after 9/11. It's based on a true story. Right after 9/11, the U.S. wanted to make some sort of strike in Afghanistan, and they sent an elite special forces unit out there with 12 guys in it, and they had to work hand-in-hand with the friendly Afghani forces, so they find a local warlord, who, by the way, the warlord this character is based on is now the current president of Afghanistan. So they work with this guy, and they have an enormous amount of culture clashes, and they have to ride horses. Only one of the guys knew how to ride horses. That's Chris Hemsworth's character.
You know, if you watch this trailer in a movie theater, as I did, walking in and not listening to it, you think it's a comedy. You don't think it's possible that they really rode horses in Afghanistan after 9/11 because they couldn't get, the right jeeps, or they couldn't get the right kind of...
The streets are too narrow for any kind of vehicles?
They were pretty much in very, very rocky terrain with no roads. They shot it, of course, in New Mexico, but it takes place in... And it was directed by a first-time director whose name is Neil something-something that I can't pronounce, but... You kind of wish that maybe Clint Eastwood had done this. It's an interesting story. We've never heard it. It's true.
Why are they
classified?
Why are
it's
they
the wild bunch in Afghanistan.
Why are they riding horses?
Because horses can deal with these roads and in this kind of terrain, and they had a couple burros too.
Can audiences deal with this movie in any terrain?
It's fine. It's fine. It's the culture clash stuff gets played up way too often. Every time they talk to an Afghani, it's some sort of, well, you know, in his culture they do this, and they think this, and we shouldn't do that.
Nikolai Fuggles.
That's why I didn't try to pronounce it.
Fuggles is the director of the movie.
That sounds a lot like Neil something something to me.
That's right.
I think Bill had it right in the first place. So this is a good film.
It's a good film for this time of year.
Yeah, we've talked at length, and Neil, you'll back me up on this when you're done looking at porn on the computer. It's the January, you want to mispronounce it again? It's the January, dumping ground. This is the toxic waste time of the year, and except for The Commuter, which we talked about last week, and Mike, did you like The Commuter with Liam?
You know, I didn't see The Commuter. I was supposed to go to a screening. How was that?
It's really not bad at all. I called it ridiculously entertaining. And the point is, normally we get shit in January, and that was okay. But now, let's be honest, we're going to see mostly the stuff that couldn't get a slot anytime.
Well, so you recommend 12 Strong.
Yeah, if you have nothing else to do.
And is it funny?
It's funny. Michael Pena is one of the actors in it, and Michael's...
Michael Shannon.
Yeah, Shannon's in it. He's not the comedian of the group, though. Right. you'd be
Chris
hoping
Hemsworth?
For a whole lot if you could get Michael Shannon.
Is Chris Hemsworth the comedian of the group?
No, Michael Pena is the comedian of the group. And he's very funny. And it's interesting because he started his career doing serious movies. And then they realized around Ant-Man, I think, that he was funny. And he's good. He cracks up the jokes in this.
Hemsworth, I understand, we talked to.
That's right. And Chris said this has a lot of elements they don't normally find in a war movie.
Read the book and was fascinated by it and the fact that it was a true story and one that I think a lot of people are unaware of. You know, we haven't seen horse-mounted cavalry charges since the First World War. And so to have modern warfare and weaponry and armor on horseback, I think, is visually pretty stunning and unique.
Yes, and you're right, Bill McCuddy, that it is the dumping ground January for a lot of crap. And next week, we'll talk about the Academy Award nominations are being released, so we'll talk about that, but which is why we're going to talk a lot about what's on TV. And one thing that I watched on TV that Mike Sargent and I saw that's really good is if you get Hulu, I would say it's a documentary. Would you say it's a documentary?
It's a documentary where they do what they call in documentaries reenactments. So there's some fun reenactments that go on in the documentary, and they have some interesting casting for some of those reenactments. Do you want me to talk further, or do you want to?
No, well, tell us, you know, we know the Bond story, obviously, but we don't know necessarily, or I do, but a lot of people don't, who George Lazenby is, and this guy who, except for Barry Nelson, who played the very first James Bond on television, is like the first guy who did it.
Well, here's what it's about, if you could, is Mike, is that, is basically, the movie starts where he's sitting in a room, George Lazenby, and he goes, I'm going to tell you my life story, and he's this Australian guy, and he's a mechanic and wasn't very happy being a mechanic, and he wanted to be promoted to become a car salesman, and he becomes a car salesman, and through happenstance and selling a car one day to somebody, you know, the guy goes, can I take your picture? And Lazenby thinks that it's some,
gay come on thing?
Yeah, exactly. But what it is
well, that's how we met.
The guy represents male models, and he takes some pictures of Lazenby, and Lazenby becomes a male model. And that all leads through a whole bunch of circumstances to him becoming, James Bond.
Well, you know, what's interesting is there's so many aspects of this story that are, you couldn't, you know, they say life is stranger than fiction, and it is. He didn't just become a model. He became like the model. He was the epitome of cool at that time for, you know, the industry. And because he modeled, people assumed, as most models still are, that they want to act or that they could act. And without giving too much away, he does end up becoming James Bond. But here's the thing. You always wonder, like, why didn't he continue? Because if you've ever seen Her Majesty's Secret Service, which was the first non-Sean Connery film after You Only Live Twice. Was it You Only Live Twice or Thunderball? Which
No, You Only Live Twice was 67, Thunderball was 65.
Right. All right, yeah. So after You Only Live Twice, Connery was walking away because they weren't compensating him. His life was going crazy. He wanted to be a serious actor. He thought he was being typecast. They find Lazenby. Lazenby's great, but they were so excited and they wanted to move on this film so quickly that they never actually signed a contract with Lazenby. He filmed the whole film without a contract. And then when it came time for contract, here's a guy who came from nowhere, was in a film, was being accepted as, he felt like it was nothing, anybody could do it, offers are going to be coming my way. They offered him 7 Bond films and $1 million cash on signing, and he turned it down.
He turned it down, and if you watch, you'll find out why he turned it down. It's also a love story. I mean, it's very interesting. It talks about this girl from he's from a lower class background, and you know, he meets this girl who's from this, who knows the guy who's head of one of the heads of parliament in Australia. And it's very, and then it's,
they have a daughter, right? Because he has a daughter with somebody.
Not with this woman. Okay. And it's also the swinging 60s. He's James Bond, and he's talking about all these, women that, on the Bond set that he's, hooking up with. And there's an actor that plays George Lazenby at, as a young man. There's an actor that plays George Lazenby as a little kid.
I don't mean to correct you guys. Lazenby, I've always said Lazenby. I've always said
it is Lazenby. But the other interesting thing is the there is a pivotal person in his life was the agent that got him the audition. Okay, because he wasn't really supposed to be at that audition. He just kind of, again, bogarted his way into it. And the agent, the been in the business forever agent, is played by Jane Seymour.
Yeah, and it's
really so he had a female. So tell people that's a Bond girl.
Exactly. It's a Bond girl. She was in Live and Let Die, which ironically was the first non-Lazenby or Lon Connery film.
Well, that was the first Roger Moore movie.
First Roger
Moore. And they wanted Moore, right? But Moore couldn't get out of The Saint. Isn't that true? Does that come up
that
in this
true.
At all? So
no,
listen.
They don't really address that. But what they address is the fact that, it's very interesting even how he gets into that audition, as Mike just alluded to. I mean, he goes to a tailor, the guy that used to make Sean Connery's suits, to like look the part. And he has an Australian accent. He had to learn how to speak, with a kind of a Scottish brogue.
Right.
It's fascinating. If you're
interested. Well, wait, I've interviewed this guy, but I haven't seen this documentary. And when I interviewed him, he was very upfront about fucking up. I fucked it up. I should have signed the contract.
Yeah.
I should have. So does he have that same remorse now, or this many years later,
says that he made a mistake. It wasn't the best career move, but he lived his life his way, and he does not have the kind of regrets that you're.
Barbara Broccoli said he was just an asshole, and she was not in charge of the company at that point.
If you're a fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm, Jeff Garlin, who plays Jeff Lowry's manager, agent on that show, plays Albert Saltzman, who's one of the producers along with Albert R. Broccoli.
Harry Saltzman and Albert Broccoli.
Right. Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman. It's great. So if you have Hulu, check out Becoming Bond. You loved it too, right, Mike?
Oh, my goodness. If you're a Bond fan, it's a must-see.
Like, and if you're not, it's still kind of cool and interesting?
Even if you're not, it's a fascinating just to see, as Neil alluded to, on the one hand, yes, of course, he knows he regrets what he did. But on the other hand, at this point, 50 years later, he lived his life. And it wasn't a bad life.
It sounds like Jean-Claude Van Damme, who made a very similar doc a couple of years ago called JVCD or JVDC or something.
JCD, yes, yeah. JCD.
It's kind of the same sort of animal?
Not really, because JCD, he put himself in there, and it was sort of self-deprecatory. Oh. This is really him telling his life story, and like Neil says, it's a love story. It's rags to riches to rags.
And it's also amusing. It's not. First of all, I agree with you. Even if you're not a Bond fan, it doesn't matter, because it's really the story of this guy who came from nowhere, who was a mechanic
and got laid a lot. Are any of the women in it? Are any of the Bond women in it?
No, there's all actresses that play these people. Like it's like a docudrama. Right. Lazenby narrates it, but it's all recreated.
Does one of the girls draw her room number on his leg like she does in the movie?
No.
And he says, "I'm feeling a little stiff right now."
Oh, no, but there is a gag about how they put with a sausage. They put a giant sausage. They strapped a giant sausage under his leg. Do you remember that gag?
Yes, I don't even want to give that away, but it's great. There's a couple of great
it's
gags
very
like that.
Funny
in
movie. Even
all right,
if
I'm
don't
in.
Like, even if you don't, you're not into the 007 movies. It's a story about how a guy rags to riches story, and then back to rags, and how fame is fleeting. How he became like the most famous guy.
I'll say one last thing on this, which is that when you ask critics what the best Bond movies are, Her Majesty's Secret Service is always in the top three or four. And so it was dismissed when it came out. Diana Rigg is in it, plays his wife for about 10 seconds.
What do you think the top three? What are your top three Bond
films? Well, most people say in this order, From Russia with Love is the number one.
That is Sean Connery's favorite.
Right.
I interviewed Sean Connery. That's where we came up with all the bits of business and really created the thing. And, even though Dr. No preceded it.
Your Connery is spot on, by the way.
Yeah. How bad was that?
It's amazing.
But that's his favorite. Okay, so most people will say From Russia with Love.
I would put Goldfinger second, and I would put Honor Majesty's Secret Service third.
What about you, Mike?
Well, I'm pretty close to being in that camp. I'd say in my top four would probably be Rush with Love, Goldfinger, and Her Majesty's Secret Service would probably be number one if Connery were in it. It's definitely my favorite score.
What about you, Bill?
Hmm. From Russia Above, Dr. No, and actually Skyfall I'd throw in there.
Okay, I would go with Goldfinger. Uh-huh. I'm going to do them by Bonds. I'm going to go with my favorite Bond one with Sean Connery is Goldfinger. My favorite one with Roger Moore is The Spy Who Loved Me. And my favorite one with Daniel Craig is Casino Royale.
And Timothy Dalton.
We're not going to do the Timothy Dalton one. And I'd have to revisit on Her Majesty's Secret Service because I've seen most of them more recently, but I just would have to revisit.
Oh, you have to. Telly Savalas is Blofeld. I mean,
with no earlobes.
Yes. My favorite line in Her Majesty's Secret Service, I don't know if you know the plot, but he's going to take over the world using women. He's going to take over the world, and he has these women who are like these sleeper agents. And at night, he talks to them through their contact, and he's, I will tell you when. I will tell you how. Right. You know, and it's great. It's a great thing.
All right, moving on.
Armand Flint has the same...
Same plot. You know.
All right, sorry. We digress because it's Bond.
All right, so I highly recommend Becoming Bond on Hulu. All right, speaking about streaming programs, David Letterman is back on television with a new show called My Next Guest Needs No Introduction, and his first guest was President Barack Obama. If you're looking for the old Late Night with David Letterman from NBC or Late Show with David Letterman for CBS, that's not what you're getting here. This is a bare-bone show. It's two chairs on a stage, and there's...
Oh, like Between Two Ferns?
No, there's no... Not even a fern. It's just two chairs on a stage in an auditorium. It's filled up with predominantly...
There's no B-roll?
I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you.
So there's more to it than that.
90% of it is just an interview with Dave. Dave comes out... He talks to the audience for about 30, 40 seconds.
So there's a live audience.
Yes, big audience. It's in a theater, and he tells...
Little millennials.
It's in an auditorium, It's
Was he funny?
It's in a universe.
Still has the beard?
Still has the beard, which is very hard to get past. And he comes out and just talks to the audience for like a minute and basically says... Well, first it starts out where he's on the phone in his office trying to get, you know, President Obama as a guest. That's about a 30-second sequence, and he tells his producer, I think that's a no. Then he comes out on stage and talks to the audience and says, Do you have any idea who our guest is today? And that there's no monologue. I mean, that's it. And then Barack Obama comes out. And then, yes, they speak for, 56 minutes. There's a whole sequence to talk about what you're talking about, Bill. Obama reflects upon... this moment that changed his life. He did not walk across the bridge in Selma, but talks about how he wishes that he was old enough at the time, which he wasn't, to do that. And they show footage of people walking across the bridge in Selma, Alabama. But it is Alabama, correct? Yes, it's Alabama. Yeah. Yeah. And there's black and white archival footage of that. And then Dave is on location there on the bridge. But I would say 90% of this thing is him just interviewing Obama on this stage. And the glaring omission of the show...
Well, I was just going to say, Obama must be great talking about Trump. I mean,
country. That's the glaring omission in the show, is because they obviously had some sort of arrangement going into this that Obama agreed to do this without talking about Trump whatsoever. I mean, the obvious question which you'd want to ask right off the bat, the first thing you'd want to say is, how do you feel about... Donald Trump.
That's ridiculous. Let me just stop you. That's just completely and utterly ridiculous.
That he doesn't ask him that?
And for the credibility that David Letterman has and the guests that he can get, I just think that they should have at least addressed it. I think Letterman should have said something about asking him about Obama, I mean about Trump, and Obama should have said, you know what, Dave? We don't know when this is going to air. I have a lot of respect for the office. I'm not going to comment at this time. Something like that.
Nothing. The only thing, the closest he comes to it, is Letterman asks him a question along the lines of, what do you think the most biggest accomplishment was during your time as president in the 8 years? And he says it's less about what I accomplished in terms of laws being passed or legislation or working with Congress or navigating political waters. It's an image that you have to project to the American people and to the world of that you're in control and that people are calm when there's a crisis, and it's kind of like a respect that you have to have for the office, and you have to have people feel comfortable that you're the president. That's something along those
lines.
You
like that answer?
And that is the close. He never mentions Trump, but he basically...
It's kind of a bullshitty answer.
Yeah, but he does not...
Bullshitty!
He does not talk about Trump, and it's kind of weird. I mean, you're watching this interview, and... Yeah, he talks
about...
Well,
they'd only gone 57 minutes, apparently.
He talks about...
like, unbelievable.
He talks about being a dad. He talks about bringing Malaya to college for the first time and getting choked up when they drove away. And then he got to assemble some kind of lamp in her dorm room for a half an hour.
Yeah, no parent
does
that.
He talks about dancing with his kids and trying to be cool. He talks about, Michelle and him, what they did when they, the first couple of
weeks. All right, who else saw this? I'm getting bored. Who did you're the only one that saw it? You were bored. You saw it for 5 minutes and got
bored. I saw the whole thing.
Mike, based on what you've heard, will you watch it?
Well, here's a question. Will I get around to it?
Well,
that's everybody's question.
Other guests on the show coming up include Malala, George Clooney's the next one, Howard Stern will be on the show.
It doesn't sound like Obama really should have been
wait,
the first
Malala, how, Malala, Obama, Howard Stern, obviously the Giants.
Yeah, well, it's not necessarily, Obama speaks very eloquently. It's interesting.
He should have led with Howard Stern.
But he talks about
Howard Stern on Martin Luther King Day. That would have been a good lead.
He talks about growing up, and he talks a lot about his mom. How his mom married someone from Africa, and how he wrote a book about his father and didn't really get.
So what's Letterman? Is he Charlie Rose without the sexual assault? Oh wait a minute, that's right. Letterman had sexual assaults. I mean, come on, this is ridiculous. I mean, I don't. I was a huge fan of David Letterman, but this sounds like a big wasted opportunity.
Well, this was
You know who had a much better time with Obama, and it was funny and fun and cool. Watch Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee when he goes to the White House.
Yeah, and they drive around.
They're driving around in that Corvette. They can't get off the premises.
Right. That was fun.
Obama talks to the guard, and the guard won't let him out. And then as they're driving away, Jerry Seinfeld has the balls to turn to the president and go, you didn't really sell it. I mean,
that was funny.
Amazing.
And they're sitting in the White House pantry or something like that, doing the interview. And he goes, that's what's great about this job. You can get something like
Rod Lurie's The Contender.
Yeah, and that
Jeff Bridges could call down.
Jeff Bridges, the American president.
No, that was The Contender.
No. All right, what do I? Okay. Anyway, so the jury's still out on the David Letterman. The new.
I want to see it with Stern. That sounds great.
That's the one I'm looking forward to. They showed next on the David Letterman. My guest needs no introduction. It's George Clooney, and they showed a clip of Clooney yelling at him, going like, "You got to get rid of that beard." He goes like, "It's like
that's
ridiculous."
Funny, and I hope Stern watched the one with Obama and yells at him for not asking Obama about Trump. That's what Howard Stern would and should do.
All right. So anyway, if you want a history lesson on Obama, and you like David Letterman, then you can take a look. But if you're looking for any current takes on what's going on, which is what pretty much I think anybody would be looking for with this interview, you're not going to find it here. All right, so, I want to talk about a movie for a second that won the Golden Globe and won the Critics' Choice Awards last week. By the way, Critics' Choice Awards, not as politically oriented as the Golden Globes in terms of the Me Too movement, I'd say.
Intentionally said they weren't going to do the all-black clothing, and that was the stars seemed kind of relieved by that. I'll tell you something about the Critics' Choice Awards, if you want to really have this conversation, is that Olivia Munn had one funny line in it, and Joey, we're members of this organization, Joey Berlin may be listening. They did one thing really well, and I'm going to give them credit for it. And that is, they gave half of the award, not half, I'm making that up. They gave a lot of awards away in an earlier telecast that was live streamed. And man, oh man, do I think that's the wave of the future. How much better would the Oscars be if we could give a bunch of that shit away on the same day, in the same auditorium, maybe in the green room?
Well, they do that on the Oscars.
No, they do it weeks earlier, and so it has no juice. There's nothing cool about it.
Well, the Tonys does that.
They could start. Listen to me. They could start in the afternoon. in the green room at the Kodak Center, and they could give like 10 of the awards away, like in the middle, like being in the middle of a newsroom, and then they could do the show. The show could be an hour shorter, and you could just give the
Oscar major... people resist change. They but that's a great idea. But you know, Bill, you know, you do work for CBS. The Tonys, the broadcast is only how much of that? Did
I know.
You,
I actually feel a little jilted after watching. Wait a second, where are the awards?
Right, I mean...
I get tired of one number after another. I thought this was an award show.
Right, what percentage, Bill, on the Tonys, on that CBS telecast, are they actually... I mean, because they go earlier than, like, this evening or something like
that? Well, the Grammys are like that, too. The Grammys go on all day with the awards you never heard of. Like, best talk...
Right, but Grammys have, like, 700 categories.
Yeah, they have a billion categories, and they go on... Oh, I mean, they start literally, like, 2 in the afternoon and go all the way up until the show you finally see on the air.
I would so much rather watch a live feed from the green room where they're giving away, or backstage somewhere, where they're giving awards away, or do them out on the red carpet, than all of that bullshit with E. And I was part of that for 12 years. I stood shoulder to shoulder with everybody asking, I didn't ask people who are you wearing, but everybody else did. Imagine if there was something substantive happening in that time period, like you were giving away best production design.
What do you think, Mike? Would you like to see a show with...
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. I mean, it's sort of this. I see pros and the cons of that. I'll be honest. Award shows, I'm not a fan of them, but I do think they have a tendency to go on too long. The Oscars is notorious for having tons and tons of, let's just say, fluff that doesn't really add, and no musical numbers that are, you know, okay, another number, and there are a lot of awards that. And here's the problem that people don't care so much about, and I think that would be the downside, is that if you become like the B awards, you know, the ones that people only watch online or only watch in the afternoon, or you have a quarter of the audience, kind of takes away from being in the same
really
room.
Care about best sound mixing on the Oscars or something?
Well, you know, people may not care, but other sound mixers do, and the people who are winning the awards would like to be in the company of all those big names, because you've never heard of them, and if they were on a separate show, you still would not have heard of
them.
The
only reason all those categories were on in earlier years is because they became part of a sweep, and there was momentum. There's no such thing as sweeps anymore. The director and picture often are given to two different movies. A movie in the last... Name a movie in the last 10 years that won more than 4 Oscars, let's say. Unless they were technical and stuff. In the last 10 years. I mean...
How long was Titanic?
97.
All right. Well, that was 20 years ago.
Okay. All I'm saying is all these lesser categories are interesting when you're building like a momentum of nominated for 15 and it won 10. Those days are over. And I think that, you know, yeah, the other sound mixers will be disappointed, but I think you could mention them in the course of the live of the broadcast. Let me reboot here. All I'm saying is the Broadcast Film Critics Association, which we are members of, did a good job of splitting it up into two things. One of the things they did for political reasons, I'm pretty sure, is they decided to give James Franco his BFCA award in that streaming ceremony so they wouldn't have to deal with it in the live program that was on
CW. Are you talking about sex now?
Yeah. You know, I was going to get to this movie.
Well, that's a good segue.
All right, I'll get to this movie in a minute. So we're taping this on a Tuesday. And the news over the last couple of days, right, as Bill McCuddy just said, is James Franco. And then there's Aziz Ansari. And then...
Who's Ansari now?
And then there's people, you know, Woody Allen. What's her name? Rebecca Hall just
said... Rebecca Hall's going to give her money.
She just shot a movie with Woody Allen.
It's raining in New York.
She's going to do the same thing.
Right. But yet these people... accepted these roles. Rebecca Hall did Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
She said it all happened after the fact. They shot this Woody Allen movie not before all this Dylan bullshit, but like they before the Me Too movement came along.
Right, but the point is that the facts on Woody Allen haven't changed since she did Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
Exactly, exactly. Right, it's just less politically correct to work with someone who was accused of something now, okay? And I have to say here, you know, sure, you're going to either believe he did or believe he didn't. Let's not even talk about his wife and Sunyi or whatever that's all about. That's a whole other conversation. But the issue of whether or not he molested his son or his daughter, okay, you know, whatever side of that you're on, okay, that is something that you knew and people have known for 20 years. To make that move now is completely political. It is all about the same reason that people are firing people without, you know, charges or anything. It's like, oh, this happened. What, you know, somebody said it happened. I do. I have to say, I kind of agree with Alec Baldwin.
Can you know? What did Alec Baldwin say?
Well, Alec Baldwin just said today. He just said, I'm going to read to you what he said here. He said, Woody Allen was investigated forensically by two states, New York and Connecticut, and no charges were filed. The renunciation of him and his work no doubt has some purpose, but it's unfair and sad to me. That's what he said. Well,
I would say amen, but that's sexist.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the allegations of James Franco and, you know, anybody, these are new allegations that are just coming to light. What I'm saying, and I think you're echoing this as well, Mike, is that, yes, is that the Woody Allen, when Rebecca Hall did Vicky Cristina Barcelona a number of years ago and then agreed to do his latest film, which is coming out, I guess, this fall or whenever it's going to come out in the summer, no new information has come to light on Woody Allen in the number of years that she's done that. The movement is what's all of a sudden, she goes, it's my biggest regret doing this movie, blah, blah, blah. I wish
yeah,
I
had... come on.
Right,
so come
the point
on.
Is, the fact
well,
Kate still...
Winslet feels the same way, but that's because Wonder Wheel sucked.
Well, I'm saying the facts on if it's her biggest regret, there's no new information that has come forth since she did Vicky Cristina Barcelona. So what is she saying here? That, like, because of the movement now, she's feeling more.
That's exactly. I agree with you. Because if it was her biggest regret, let's say Vicky Barcelona, she didn't know. There's no way she didn't know 10 years later. Okay. And if it was her biggest regret, why would you go back and work with the director you regretted the most? You regret it now because it was politically incorrect for you to have worked with this person. Now that the movement's happening, and more importantly, because the movement was really ignited by his children.
Well, so let me ask you three questions. James Franco, Aziz Ansari, and Woody Allen, are they done, or are they going to be continuing to be able to make movies?
My opinion, James Franco, I think, you know, he's got some, what's the phrase, something to hold or row or whatever. He's got some work to do. But I think Aziz is a turning point. I think Aziz is a turning point because, you know, at this point, the lines are a little blurred here, okay? There is sexual assault, there's unwanted sexual advances, and then there's sexual abuse, okay, or child molestation in the case of the stuntman or Woody Allen, those accusations. But then there's a bad date, okay? And in my opinion, not to take anything away from the fact that women are mistreated repeatedly throughout the planet and have been since, you know, men and women were whatever, made of clay, okay? But the bottom line is, you know, I would say there are a number, like, she is not guilt-free in this situation, and I don't even think that this would be an article if it weren't for today's climate. And I have to say, I do think it's. I think he was clearly an asshole on the date.
Right.
Okay.
I think that's his worst crime.
I think he was an asshole on the date, and I think he's come across as exactly what he is. He's a nerdy guy who now has power and celebrity and uses that to get women. He doesn't have any game, obviously, and he you know, there are lots of young women, okay, who would gladly sleep with a guy who's famous and successful on the first date, and she was one of them.
But Mike, not if they did that claw thing. That claw thing sounds terrible.
What claw thing?
The thing he does to women. With his fingers.
All right. Well, you know, I'm just saying. The last thing I want to say on this is now, this takes nothing away from the fact that you know, no means no, and he was super aggressive, and he was an asshole. But I'm sorry. I have a daughter. And if my daughter is foolish enough to go with a man 12 years her senior who's famous and successful, go somewhere with him, go to his apartment, have wine, then come back for a date, back to his apartment, and then they trade oral sex, and she's uncomfortable, and she doesn't leave.
Right.
There's a problem there. there. This is not a black and white issue.
She moves all over that apartment in the course of, I'm guessing, an hour and a half or 2 hours, and doesn't leave until.
Well, and yes, she's wrong for not leaving. He's wrong for pushing it further. But hello, that's not a black and white. Like, he's just completely wrong. That's
Bill
what
Rizzoli,
I think.
Think out of those three people that I mentioned, where do you think the careers are going to stand?
Who are the guys again?
Aziz Ansari, James Franco.
Who are the guys again?
Buying time, that's called.
It's like a Miss America tech.
Woody Allen, be able to make more movies again? What do you think?
How many movies have you got left in him? He does, what, one a year?
Well, do you think
it'll be a couple of years?
Better question is, will this film get released?
Years old,
well, if you want the real answer to this, there are a couple of really good articles about that do the math, okay? He needs $25 million. He can't get it anymore from Amazon, was the last person that underwrote it. Amazon will not give him money this time around. So he'll have to go
because
to Europe.
Because
of this. Yeah. So he'll have to go to Europe, where they say he can raise $8 to $10 million, but he doesn't have a big enough name. He has support. People like Woody Allen in Europe.
He did that.
But he doesn't have gone to London, but those were tandem productions. Those were things that involved distribution over here, but movie production over there. If he's entirely dependent on getting the money in Europe, he can't get enough money to make the kinds of movies he's been making up until now. But let me tell you something. I think this is a really sad note to go out on. But I think this is going to be his retirement moment. I mean, he's been making a movie a year for the last 83 years.
Right, Franco. Franco continues, or is he done?
Oh, but
we're done for a while.
Maybe they'll cut down to one James Franco in the next iteration.
As opposed to the 50 movies a year that he does, you mean?
Maybe he'll do less, and maybe we'll only have to watch one of them when they do, what was that movie about 42nd Street? Or the TV series.
That was called The Deuce.
Oh, The Deuce.
The Deuce, yeah. Can't just have one James Franco.
Is that The Deuce?
I know that deal.
He'll cut one of the Deuces.
Well, Franco has made a ton of bombs.
Right.
Well, he makes a ton of movies.
A ton.
Is The Deuce been renewed?
Yeah, I think so.
Does he know why?
The first day, the day after premiere.
Look, the real problem with this conversation is we're having it in the middle of this whole controversy, and which I'm happy to have this conversation. I've said three podcasts ago that the problem I have with it is the punishment is the same no matter what the crime is. Everybody's losing their careers. Some people went a little too far on a date. Other people molested people, and they're all ruined for the rest of their lives.
That's exactly what was my point.
At some point in this process, the Me Too movement is going to have to say, you know what? Just say you're sorry, or do this, or do that. But we don't know what that thing is yet.
You think there's going to be an I'm sorry movement?
I think there's going to be something that men are going to come forward and. I don't know if we're going to get the Hayes Act back. I think we're going to get codes of conduct. They already have one on the Today Show that they all have to sign now. And you're guilty if you know about it and don't report it. So I think if that sort of thing is what becomes the end game here, so we can have some kind of way to appease everybody. Otherwise, everybody's going to be out of work in Hollywood. And it's just starting in Hollywood. It's going to go all through all industries.
All right.
Well, in all industries. And I can tell you something, gentlemen, very, very disturbing. Okay. And I don't know how much of you are social media people, but there is a quote-unquote movement, and I only learned about this last night. The hashtag is It Ain't Rape. And it's mind-bogglingly disturbing that there are men, and the things that they're saying, it makes you ashamed to be a man, but it is indicative that there's clearly a problem in how men perceive women, and you know, if there was anything about the Aziz situation, it is that the perception of what women should, or how women should be treated, period, has to change.
All right.
You know, from dating to hiring.
Aziz will deal with it on his show. He'll be okay. Franco's going to take a while. He'll be back. Woody Allen is done.
Okay. Speaking about... yes, I was going to...
You didn't end that, Bill, with, so let it be written, so let it be done.
All right. So what I was going to...
Thank you, Darth Vader.
What led me into this conversation was we talked about... Bill McCuddy saw this movie a couple of... weeks ago, we talked about it briefly, but I've seen it since then, and Mike Sargent has seen it. It won, as I said, the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Language Film, and it won the Critics' Choice for the same category. It's called In the Fade, and I think it's terrific. It's It's in subtitles. What's the language on it? It's is it German?
Yeah,
I think it's German. Yes,
German and Greek.
Her husband is Muslim, and it starts out he's in prison, but for drug dealing. They get married. He lives a straight life, a crime-free life, so you're to speak.
This is all like the first 3 minutes.
The first couple
We're not
of
giving
minutes.
Anything away.
And she goes to a day spa or something, and her husband and her son are blown up.
Her 5-year-old son.
Yeah, in a terrorist attack. And it is about the trial that takes place afterwards and some possible... you know, maybe there's a vigilante. I'll take.
Yeah, we talked
in my
about this.
Hands.
We gave the plot and talked about it.
Right, and I think Diane Kruger is terrific in it.
I think she's great.
And I like the film. I highly recommend it. And you know, it's an intelligent movie, and it talks about the justice system in Germany. And you know, and
I think it's got a real shot at winning the Oscar as the foreign candidate.
Well, yeah. Apparently, they were talking about some other films winning, but now that it's won these two things, I think it's a front runner. What do you think of the film, Mike?
Too, and it was a surprise to me on a lot of levels because the title I didn't understand. In the Fade, what did that mean? And Diane Kruger, I've never been a fan, but after seeing this, I'm like, wow, like this woman can really.
Inglourious Bastards was what I was going to say too.
I never saw Inglourious Bastards. All right, so that's you know, that's mine. But so again, I never drank the Diane Kruger Kool-Aid, so I never knew
her only other
I thought
film
she was great.
You don't like her.
Okay. You talked about it. I'm just saying it. I highly recommend it.
Yeah,
I think it's
highly recommend it.
We love it when you catch up, Neil. We love it when you catch up.
Okay, well, here's something that is new. The first season that Bill McCuddy and I saw, the first episode aired of Crashing, the Pete Holmes comedy written and directed some of the episodes by, but certainly all of them produced by Judd Apatow. About in the first season, Pete was his wife leaves him, and he decides he wants to be a comedian, and he starts hanging out in these really bad little comedy clubs in the Village in New York City, and it's kind of in Sarah Silverman crashes in Sarah Silverman's house. Artie Lang's in it. I was on the set for the finale episode that they shot out, on location somewhere last season. I gotta tell you, you know. I'm not. It's okay. I'm not dancing over the premiere episode of the second season.
Well, and they certainly did you notice one of the guys was one of our guests from
Dan Natterman.
Dan Natterman.
Done our TV
it was his
show
birthday.
Podcast.
They go to
it's
the box. Podcast. People don't know what the box is around the country. It's this sort of sophisticated burlesque kind of show. And it's got a lot of stars
it's
in it.
Dan's birthday.
Penn Jillette is in it. And listen, I think it suffers from what a lot of these first-year, moderately successful shows suffer from, which is the first one coming back, we're going to load it with stars. And we saw that happen this season on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Not its second season, but certainly guilty of that. And this one was sort of chock-a-block with comedy folk. By the way, is that the fabled table that you've sat at the comedy set? Was that booth
where
all the people were
sitting? No, that's done somewhere else.
Okay,
that
fine.
Was not the actual booth at the
Neil talks set. About this like legendary table at the Comedy Cellar where you get invited to sit down. It seems so old school. I thought, well, they were certainly reenacting that at this
yes,
moment.
Yes, but that's not the table.
Okay.
That's
so,
not the table. It's a recreation of
I don't
table.
Love Pete Holmes. I think his stand-up's gotten better in the show, or at least they're writing him funnier
bits in
the show.
That's the problem I have, too, is Pete Holmes just isn't that funny to me. He's a really nice guy. I mean,
super
I've interviewed
nice.
Him.
And you can tell. And that's basically playing himself. You know, he doesn't drink. He's religious. And so he breaks both of those taboos in this first episode. I'm going to stick with it because I think he gets the
I'm
comedy
stick
world.
With it, too. But I wasn't that impressed with the first episode. And, you know, part of the problem
and
is...
And Judd Apatow co-wrote it with him, this first one.
Yeah. I mean, it just... The whole conceit around the first episode, the whole plot is about the fact that he's like, his beliefs are challenged by Penn Jillette. As you said, he goes on a bender and, you know, and right, I'll stick with it. Maybe it'll get better, you know, but I wasn't that drawn into the first episode.
Now, speaking of catch up, you're always telling me that I've got to watch this Black Mirror thing, and I finally saw the first episode with Jesse Plemons.
USS Callister.
Loved it, loved it.
Mike saw that too. I mean, I'm late to the party. I watched it last night. No less than my daughter came to me yesterday and said, she's 17, and you haven't seen this episode yet? And I
and
go,
Lily,
you don't know anything about Star Trek. She goes, you don't have to know anything about Star Trek. She goes, course, I got it right away. It's a ripoff of She Thought a movie. And I was like, okay, so I sat down for, you said 31 minutes, an hour and 17. Again, your math is
really?
Not that great. But,
well, the time flew by because I loved it so much.
Yeah, here's my headline.
You didn't see it.
The girl who's featured prominently in it is like
great.
From nowhere. And she's as much to me going to be a star as much as your delightful Rachel Brosnahan or whatever.
Rachel Brosnahan, who won the Golden Globe and won the Critics' Choice Award. I think that's a little better look at stand-up comedy than Crashing.
Okay, anyway.
One's contemporary and one takes place in the late 50s.
The young woman who plays in that is amazing. And then let me recommend as my video pick of the week another up-and-coming talent that I think is going to be hugely... I think she's going to be the next big thing. Her name is Quinn Shepherd, and she wrote, directed, and stars in a movie now called Blame, which is basically The Crucible with high school students. And actually, they're doing a production of it. They're doing a production of The Crucible in it. Chris Messina's in it as a teacher who's a little
now
too attracted
this?
To this. It's on. It's streaming on a lot of platforms. It's on demand, but it's on.
Okay.
It's a couple.
So you got to buy it.
It's not. Yeah.
It doesn't come with your Netflix
no.
or Amazon Prime.
Not that I'm aware of. Blame. It's called. Quinn Shepherd is the star. I highly recommend it.
Okay.
It's great.
Okay. Also want to talk about on DVD this week and on demand. Last Flag Flying with Bryan Cranston and Steve Carell. Do you guys see that?
Lawrence Fishburne. I saw it. Basically, it's a remake of The Last Detail with Nicholson and Randy Quaid.
Well, I mean, it took a long time getting anywhere.
And guess who's behind this? And, you know, this is, like, really surprising to me. Richard Linklater is the definitely director. And I thought it was kind of a misfire. I thought it was okay.
Tell
it
us
got
about
me
it,
at
Bill.
The end, but
we don't have to. We discussed this before.
All right. In a sense.
We talked about
catch up, Neil.
It's guys coming back. It's guys coming back from. It's guys that reunite like 40
yeah, reunite
50 years
to bury
after.
One of their the guy's
from
sons.
Son, yeah.
Give him full military.
They take the body to Arlington, maybe, and it's a road trip, and it's got a couple. It's got some winning scenes in it. Lawrence Fishburne is great as the hellion turned into a pastor, where they stay a night, and then they pick him up, and he joins the troop. But and it gets you at the end. It's definitely
did you like it, Mike?
At the end.
I did, but I agree with Bill. It no surprises. I thought it was well done. You know, well acted. You know, I wouldn't say by the numbers, but terms like conventional, seen it before, kind of come to mind.
And it's no Last Detail, right?
No. But again, Last Detail at that time was new. You know, so there are a lot of things.
I saw like the first 40 minutes of it, and then on a screener. Was not drawn into it, and I have to get back to that. Before we go...
Well, I just want to say about Lawrence Fishburne. He's a member of a club called the Grand Havana Room here in New York and also in Beverly Hills. I did a charity event there the other night for the Fuente family for Opus X Cigars and this charitable foundation that builds houses and schools down in the Dominican Republic for kids, and they gave me a box of cigars, a box of Opus X's, but...
Yes, you asked me to ask you about this box of cigars.
Yes, I brought... Well, the only reason I asked you to ask me about
it... Did you bring cigars and I'm not there?
Yeah, and read what's on the bottom of the box, Neil. This is Fuente's best cigars, the Opus X.
On the bottom of the
box?
Yeah,
and there's a sample of what each of the cigars has on it, the label there. It's across the bottom.
There is nothing on the bottom of this box.
Yeah, there's it's right in
here,
front of you.
Why don't you take a look?
Read it to us, Bergoglio. What does it say?
It says William McCuddy, Private Reserve.
Yes, so I have my own.
Oh, that's not the.
I have my
of the
own
box.
Brand
that's
of cigars on the. Would that be the bottom of the box, Bill?
Yeah.
Okay, I rest my case. Anyway, thanks for playing along. Anyway, Opus, great company, not just because they named a cigar after me and it's only one box, but because a lot of stars go to this Grand Havana Room, and I want us to do this podcast from there one of these weeks. So maybe we'll be joined by some of the... Alec Baldwin, you mentioned earlier, is a member, and so is Mel Gibson, but we'll go anyway. So thanks to those folks.
So next week, the Academy Award nominations are being announced, and we will tell you our take on what we think of that.
And can I mention one more thing about Diane Kruger and in that movie, In the Fade?
Please do.
She's an actress who's been around for a minute. She's a former model, and she's done a bunch of French films. She's done a bunch of American films. This is the first film she's done in her native language of German.
Well, what do you know?
I did not know that. That should be a DVD bonus extra.
There you go. Well, from my
I also think that at the end of the show, these kind of shows that we're doing here, these would be the sitting around talking movies NCS, because it's the Neil Catch-Up show.
That's very funny. All right. Well, anyway, Mike Sargent, thanks for joining us remotely
from his deathbed, ladies and gentlemen. Mike, remind us of your website and how can we follow you on social media?
Well, on social media, I'm Mike at Mike on Screen is my Twitter. And
Mike on Screen.
Mike on Screen is my Twitter.
His Twitter handle. And Bill McCuddy, as usual.
At Bill McCuddy, also contributor now to GoldDerby.com. Got a fun thing about Jane Goodall the other day. One of the chimps tried to have sex with her. And I'm also an Oscar contributor to the New York Post this season.
And Gold Derby.
That's what I just said, Gold Derby.
You said New York Post.
Oh, Gold Derby.
Okay.
Gold Derby has a thing about Jane, the documentary.
Okay.
Brett Morgan, the
one day
director.
Bill Bregoli will get on social media, maybe.
I'm getting on the subway in just a few minutes.
Okay. And I'm going to get Yellow Rose and Apples, and we'll talk on Oscars next week. And thanks for sitting around talking movies with us, and we'll sit around talking movies with you next week.